This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will discuss the top stories in state and national politics with two guests from different perspectives, and we will welcome the issue, the story in the news from this past week that you would like to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. Happy to have with us Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Good morning.
Good morning. It's Friday the 13th. The weather forecast for the weekend is terrible, and we have the worst presidential election in history coming up in 6 months. What else could possibly go wrong?
Well, let's ask John Nichols, who's the associate editor of the Capital Times, Washington correspondent for The Nation, and author of The S-Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism. But what else could go wrong, John?
Well, I don't want to disagree with Steve, but I would just say I'm enjoying almost everything about this presidential election. I think it's the presidential election we had to have, and we're actually having a very it is unsettling, disturbing, freaking a lot of people out, and it's probably about time. We should have done that.
Well, it is. Let's start with one of the top stories this week. A presumptive GOP nominee, Donald Trump, and House Speaker Paul Ryan met yesterday after a tense week between the two. Paul Ryan had said that he was not yet ready to endorse Trump, and Trump fired back that he wasn't ready to support the speaker's agenda either. Prompted speculation that that Trump might ask Ryan to step down as chair of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in July. Ryan said he would if he was asked. Well, after the meeting, it reportedly went well. I think Reince Priebus said it went great. Steve, so what do you think? Is the Republican Party ready to rally around Donald Trump?
I don't think that is the case yet, and I certainly do not believe that people who are conservatives, who are not necessarily Republicans, are willing to do that either. I will say that, if you believe that, if everything you believe about politics is based on the maximum amount of cynicism, you're going to have everything confirmed in the next 6 months or so. I mean, you've had people in the last couple of weeks. Ron Johnson says he'd support Donald Trump. There have been others who say they would support Donald Trump, despite the fact that Donald Trump is kind of the ultimate Republican in name only, and self-named Republican in name only. When you look at his record and when you look at the things that he suggested, well, okay, at least the things he suggested in the last couple of days, since everything seems to flip-flop, he's not a Republican by any acceptable definition. He had earlier in the week, or I guess it was late last week in West Virginia, he said, yeah, I don't need any conservative votes. Well, I think that seems to be an invitation to, actual conservatives to say, hey, fine, you think you can win the election without getting conservative votes? Go for it. I'm not going to support you. And I just continue to think that we're doomed as a country if this is truly going to be the presidential election we have between two of the most disliked, hated people in the history of politics, at least in my lifetime, and maybe even longer than that.
All right. John, are we doomed?
No. We survived Warren Cox versus Warren Harding. I'm sorry, James Cox, I guess, versus Warren Harding. We can handle disappointing candidates and have frequently throughout our history. It's a strong country. Look, here's the bottom line on what's happened on the Republican side. I think that Steve's right. Donald Trump is not a conservative. He's certainly not a liberal. Donald Trump's Donald Trump. He is what he is. He's a authoritarian, very powerful guy who one interesting thing about him is it took him less time to figure out the Republican Party and figure out how to beat its elites than it did for him to build a building. Right. I mean, what he's proven is that the Republican Party was a false construct. You had a very wealthy elite that funded its campaigns, And those campaigns then told a lot of working class and middle class folks, you know, elect us. We're going to do all these things for you. We're going to make everything work well for you. We're going to trickle down some economics. We're going to, you know, have social policies you like, all that stuff. Well, it was always a lie. The elites wanted lower taxes. They wanted free trade. They wanted all sorts of things that benefited them. And what happened was Trump stepped in and he just got intervened between the elites and the great mass of people who identify as Republicans or independent leaning Republicans. And he pointed upwards and he said, those people up at the top have been lying to you forever. And the great mass of Republicans agreed. They said, yeah, of course, that's very obvious. Now, polling suggests right now that Trump is sort of on something of a rise because Republicans are uniting around him. His poll numbers are going up in a lot of battleground states. The portion of Republicans that support Trump is getting very close to the level that you saw that supported Mitt Romney, that supported John McCain. It's not quite at the level that that he needs to be at, but he's getting in the range. This tells you a lot about the Republican Party. The Republican Party was built on a false foundation. What Paul Ryan is trying to do is defend that foundation. He is failing, and he will endorse Donald Trump. And he will then try as best he can to defend as much of that elite foundation as possible. But it's going to be really hard for him. And it's going to be, you know, it's a bit embarrassing because Ryan really is a very proper guy. He tries to do things the right way. But at the end of the day, he will be chairman of that convention, which will make him the engineer on the Trump train.
Oh. So, Steve, Ryan said yesterday that he was not yet ready to endorse or support Donald Trump even after the meeting. Do you agree with John? Do you think that endorsement is coming and he's going to be the conductor of the Trump train?
Well, it's my position that Ryan and anyone else who is a real Republican and, you know, believes in principles instead of merely getting elected should not have anything to do with that. But I tend to think, again, taking the most cynical possible view that John is correct and that, you know, there's going to be this big moment on the convention platform where everybody has a big, hey, we're all on the same side. And at that point, I hope I'm not watching TV because I may end up destroying my TV. We just purchased it. So, you know, I keep reading and hearing from Republican-leaning people saying, well, yeah, it's a lesser of two evils, but look at Hillary compared to, you know, him. And I also have found online this quote, and it's from a guy named Charles Spurgeon who said, of two evils, you should choose neither. Christians must turn from the endless cycle of voting for the lesser of evils and expecting an unrighteous act to produce a righteous result. From a communist to a cultist, choosing the lesser of evils is still evil. And never should we do evil that good may come. I understand not all listeners are Christians, but, you know, if you have two bad choices, why are you going to make one of those bad choices? I'm going to have to do what I think John has suggested in the past. I'm going to have to actually research candidates not named Trump and Clinton from other parties to see where. It's either going to be that or I'm going to be running myself. So, you know, that's where we're
right in Steve Prestigard.
Steve is too young to be president.
Yeah, right.
But look, here's the interesting dynamic of it. And I do recommend researching all the candidates because we are a two-party system as defined by the elites. There's nothing constitutional about that. There's nothing that says that must be the case. And I certainly hope that 2016, because of its incredible volatility, will open people up to, you know, the range of possibilities politically. I always want that to be the case. And, you know, a while back I interviewed Gary Johnson, who's the Libertarian candidate for president. And the interesting thing is he's having quite a ride of late because he's saying, look, I'm a former two-term Republican governor who happens to be socially kind of liberal on some things, but economically very conservative, you know, on a whole bunch of things. And he may get a good vote. There may be a portion of people that will go to him. Unfortunately, the crisis of our times, right, is the extreme cynicism of media and political elites. And media and political elites will so focus on the Trump, likely the Trump-Clinton race, and they'll do so obsessively that people will, as in 64 with Johnson-Goldwater, which was a similarly intense race, you pushed the third-party candidates to the side. You ended up in a situation where people thought it was so urgent to vote that you, actually your third-party vote was one of the lowest in history in 64. And the only counsel I would give is that Steve quoted some wonderful, I think, biblical and religious comments as regards choosing the lesser of evils, which I share as a Quaker. But I would counsel also that Eugene Victor Debs, the great socialist, said when you choose the lesser of two evils, you still get evil. And so we will wrestle with those issues as a country. But at the end of the day, I fear, this is my cynicism coming through, and I usually don't like to surface it, but I fear that we have such a failed media system in this country, such a dysfunctional media system in this country, that it will literally drive people toward an urgent choice between two candidates who, as Steve points out, they don't like all that much. And the end result is that those who object will not look for a third-party candidate. I mean, I hope they do. I hope they all look for alternatives or you know, make their cross lines of partisanship and ideology. But my fear is that we might actually have a surprisingly lower turnout of people who just opt out and say they don't want to be a part of this. I hope I'm wrong about that.
There certainly was talk about finding a candidate to launch what might be considered a major third-party effort, including Mitt Romney's name was being bantied about, and others. Steve, do you want to see something like that?
I'm not him specifically, but, you know, I do believe that there needs to be somebody who actually represents the stated principles of the Republican Party, which, again, is not Donald Trump. You know, how can you possibly be credibly considered a Republican when you've spent much of your adult life supporting your Democratic friends, Hillary Clinton and others? You know, Republicans claim to be, well, maybe conservatives claim to be opposed to crony capitalism. That's a familiar term, I think. Well, if there is not a bigger crony capitalist than Donald Trump, I can't imagine who that person is. There's really almost nothing that Donald Trump has accomplished in the world of business that doesn't involve taxpayer money and doesn't involve paying off certain people to make sure that his, you know, that his projects took place. Well, that's, you know, some people may think that's a Republican thing. I don't, but I don't think it's a conservative or libertarian thing either. I think the big question, the big problem you're going to have is, you know, coming up with a non-Trump Republican who's willing to run, because let's face it, that person is probably going to be kind of, you know, kissing off their GOP future unless, as I tend to think is going to happen, the election in November with Trump on top of the Republican ticket is going to be such an enormous disaster that maybe the GOP leadership thinks, hey, maybe we're doing this wrong. I think the other person who really seriously needs to run a third party campaign is Bernie Sanders, because regardless of how you feel about the positions he's taken versus Hillary Clinton, it ought to be perfectly obvious that the Democratic National Committee decided a long time ago that Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee and nobody else was going to get a shot. I think that, you know, I'm not a fan of Sanders, but I think it's pretty obvious he has been very badly treated by the Democratic leadership. And I'm not going to be a hypocrite and say, well, you know, only Sanders should run. I would be fine with, as you pointed out, a non-Trump Republican running. You know, if there's going to be a year where you have, like, multiple credible presidential candidates, it might as well be this year, because Clinton and Trump, I said this on my blog last week, choosing between Clinton and Trump is kind of like choosing between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in the 1930s before World War II got going. And you can decide on your own which side is which.
What do you think about, should Bernie Sanders run as an independent, John? He's been, the system was rigged against him. That's what Trump says.
I don't think Bernie Sanders will run as an independent. He's said from the start that he chose to run in the Democratic primaries because, knowing all the challenges that might go with that, because he feels that the system is structured so against third-party candidates that there really is a sort of a fix in. You want to talk about rigged. The ultimate rigging is that it is rigged toward a two-party system. Our media seems to be incapable of covering multi-party politics, even covering multi-candidate primaries, as is evidenced by the Trump situation. Our political elites benefit from having a two-party system, which they can more easily control. Even the Commission on Presidential Debates does everything it can to keep third-party candidates out. So I don't think you're going to see that. If I could just, you know, I know that I hope we're not over on our break time, but if I can just throw one little thought in here, too. It's interesting that yesterday, in regard to all the things that Steve was saying, Paul Ryan had an interesting stumble in his press conference after the meeting with Trump. He referred to the Republican Party as the conservative party and didn't correct himself. I think it was literally just a stumble. But it's a fascinating thing because I think that a lot of people believe the Republican Party is a conservative party. That's absurd. It has not held to any core set of conservative values as defined historically. It certainly didn't under Ronald Reagan. It certainly didn't under George Bush. I think the Republican Party has been militantly at odds with conservatism for a long time, as the Democratic Party has often been very much at odds with liberalism and progressivism. And so we live in this fantasy that these parties are extremes or that they stand for something. The fact is that they are political organizations largely about keeping certain people in positions of power. Trump has disrupted that on the Republican side. What I think we will see is the vast majority of Republicans will decide they like power more than their supposed ideology, and so they will jump on board with Trump. Similarly, on the Democratic side, I think you will see the vast majority of people jump on board with Clinton because even though they may disagree with her on some issues, it is this kind of horrible pressure on both, you know, on our, not on the parties, but on our politics in general, to kind of fit into these two zones. At some point, maybe this is the year, we begin to break that up. And we will find, in my view, this is just my view, the multi-party democracy is incredibly healthier for a country because people can actually vote for something rather than against something. My fear about 2016 is that we're headed toward a vote against something election on both sides, rather than a vote for.
John, you know our clock too well. We are past break time, but we will take that break now, and then we will take your calls as we talk about the latest developments in the 2016 presidential race during this edition of The Week in Review. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll talk national politics first, and then we'll get into some state politics a little bit later in the program. Our guests are John Nichols, associate editor of the Capital Times, Washington correspondent for The Nation, and Steve Prestigard, who is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. Today, talking with Steve Prestigard and John Nichols about the top stories in state and national politics, welcoming your input and the issues that you would like us to discuss. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, I mentioned that Central Time will be talking about Paul Ryan and his primary challenger here in Wisconsin. Sarah Palin came out on the attack against Paul Ryan this week in an interview, vowing to campaign for his Wisconsin GOP primary opponent, Paul Neelan, who is a Trump supporter. Saying that they were going to, canterize Paul Ryan, referring to him being ousted, perhaps in his home district here. Steve, what do you think of this? That's what you think of it. Huh?
At this point, yeah, I'm kind of wondering when Jesse Ventura is going to show up in the state, or if there is a less relevant Republican as far as that race goes. I can't think of one as far as Sarah Palin. I have to say, going back about 8 years, I believe that I probably said or wrote that Palin was a good VP choice for John McCain. Clearly, I was wrong about that because she has become a joke. Among other things, Marquette University's law school did a poll about a month or maybe 2 months ago, and I believe the correct number is that Ryan is supported with 82% of people in his district versus, I think, 14% who don't support him. I understand that there is, you know, great dissatisfaction with Congress, but, you know, there is no danger, really, unless something very strange happens and Ryan screws up somehow. There is no danger, really, that he's going to end up losing a primary race to Paul Nealon, and if, who is, by the way, somebody who apparently has never run for anything before and is not really very connected in a congressional district. The problem, of course, is if the strange things happen, we have to remember that the first congressional district is not really a safe Republican district. Les Aspin, who is a Democrat, held it for, good Lord, more than 20 years, I believe, and he was replaced by a Democrat, Peter Barca, who was then replaced by Mark Newman, who was then replaced by Ryan. So it's not like this is a, you know, it's not like Jim Sensenbrenner's district where no Democrat might as well run. You know, there's a real danger here, but I don't think that there is a threat to Paul Ryan specifically.
Let's take a call from Joe in Milwaukee before we get John to respond. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I agree with John very much that we have one of the worst medias, I think, in the developed world. And certainly one example of why that is, the very elections that we're going through now are crazy. But people like Sarah Palin, for example, I mean, she would be in some version of Saturday Night Live and other Western democracies. No one would certainly can take her seriously otherwise. And I think that this, you know, beggars the question, and I realize it's not directly on, but I think we missed the boat when we started as a republic back in the 1780s. And since we were so old, we didn't adopt a parliamentary system of government where we have a figurehead of state and like a king, queen, president, whatever you want to call them, and then a head of government, usually called a prime minister. We have a crazy system where one person is both head of state and head of government, and it's extremely dangerous in the 21st century.
Yeah, I'm not sure we can go into great detail there, whether we missed the boat on what kind of system we have, but the media shouldn't be giving Sarah Palin a voice, and Donald Trump is part of Joe's comment. What do you think, John?
Oh, I love Wisconsin Public Radio callers because they go to the heart of the matter, and we should probably do a show on a parliamentary system. It's a worthy topic to be sure, and we've changed a lot over history. We didn't have an elected Senate at the beginning of our country. We had a vice president be the guy who came in, or in that case, the guy who came in second. So we can, you know, constitutional change is a possibility. I just don't think it's on the table right now. As regards the media issues that Joe brings up, yeah, I think the media has defined this race much more than party leaders and more than candidates. The over coverage of Trump has been madness. Yesterday, after Ryan had his press conference, some Senate Democrats, prominent Senate Democrats, were having a press conference, but some of the cable networks didn't actually air the volume from that because if they showed it in the corner of the screen, they had a picture of Trump's plane getting ready to leave, right? And apparently they were you know, taking time to stow the future of the Republican Party in the luggage bin. But he's getting ready to leave, and they kept talking over that Trump may be there soon to depart. And so the obsessive coverage of Trump has defined this race. There's no question of that. There was a survey at the end of last year that showed, for instance, on ABC Evening News, the ratio of coverage of Trump to Bernie Sanders, who were polling at roughly the same level in national polls and battleground states at that point, was 80-1. And then when they went in and actually analyzed the one, it turned out it was a 20-second segment, which meant it was 240-1. Ratio. And so Trump has been so dramatically overcovered that he defined the Republican race, and I would argue to some extent the Democratic race, and the whole of this game. So Joe is exactly right. It's a disaster. As regards Sarah Palin, she has a right to speak. And frankly, she is the one of the immediate former vice presidential candidates of the Republican Party. You can love that or hate that, but she is certainly a reality in our politics. I'm not particularly impressed with what she says. And I agree with this. Let's go to the core point, because we were talking about this Ryan Nayland race. I think that Nayland was probably harmed more than helped by the fact that Sarah Palin says she's excited about him. But this gets to another problem of overcoverage of Palin, perhaps, undercoverage of other developments in that race. Laura Ingraham, who has a very popular conservative radio show, has done long interviews with Nayland. Other conservative figures have stepped up and highlighted him. What I'm seeing in that race is not necessarily a likely defeat for Paul Ryan. I think he works his district hard. He knows his district, and he spends time on the ground there. So he's more secure than a lot of, you know, elite, senior, Wall Street-oriented politicians. But anybody who thinks that Nayland is just going to be pushed aside is being silly. Nayland has produced good, solid videos. He's got a solid critique of Ryan. In a low turnout Republican primary, he can be a factor. He can give Ryan a scare and force Ryan to have to participate in that race. And one thing that Steve says is, you know, that district used to be more of a swing district. Paul Ryan and his allies in the legislature gerrymandered it horribly. And all of our congressional districts are gerrymandered in Wisconsin. And so as a result, it's more Republican leaning. Ryan would only face a November threat if the Republicans really tank politically, if they have just a horrible, horrible result. However, it's important to note that the last time they had a bad ride in 2012 in Wisconsin, Ryan ran weaker than any incumbent, and he was the weakest. You know, he got for his race the worst finish that he'd had in history in a district roughly similar to this. So, end result, what I would say about all this is that Ryan's vulnerabilities are not intense. He's not, you know, likely to get beaten, but they are such that he has a personal interest in making sure that the Republican ticket functions this year. And that's one of the many, many reasons why he will endorse Donald Trump and will work hard to make that work. I just think that's a political reality, because he doesn't want the Republican Party to have such a weak finish in Wisconsin that it begins to make his power base, the first district, vulnerable.
So, I meant to ask Steve. John already said he believes that that Ryan will endorse Trump and Ryan will chair the Republican convention. Is that what you see happening?
Oh yeah, it's because political parties, first and foremost, whatever they were before, like the Republican Party started in ripping as an anti-slavery party in the 1850s, whatever they used to be, thanks to the growth of government far beyond what anybody should have intended, and you know the fact that these people make 200 grand a year in Washington, and you know Rolls Royce government benefits, and various other things. The fact is, the political parties are first and foremost about getting people with the label R or D elected and reelected. So, yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, principles, things like freedom and limited government and all of those sorts of things go out the window when you're talking about winning elections and the stakes in winning elections. So, yeah, Ryan will and Scott Walker will endorse Trump. Ron Johnson, I think, already sort of has. And frankly, I'm disgusted by it, but that is the most cynical yet probably realistic view of it.
There's a report out this week that found that news curators of Facebook have in the past suppressed some conservative news topics, including some items about Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. It has some lawmakers in Congress calling for an investigation of Facebook and how Facebook shares posts. Let's start with you. Both of you have journalism backgrounds. What do you think, Steve? Did some sort of journalistic sin committed here by Facebook, or do they have rights as a private company to curate news as they see fit?
Well, that's really not an either-or question. I think they, it's difficult to say because Gizmodo didn't put anybody's name on as their sources. So obviously, you can make up anything if your name isn't on it. I tend to think that the report is more or less accurate. I tend to think also that, you know, as you pointed out, Facebook is not a public utility. Facebook is a private business. They have the right to run the business as they want, and people have the right to read or not read Facebook as they want, the same court, you know, the same way that they can watch the big three networks or CNN or whoever and not, you know, or not. I do think there's a phrase from the Gizmodo story that reported this: select group of professionals with vaguely center-left sensibilities. And I think that if you looked, excuse me, at any newsroom in a daily newspaper in this state or a TV station, not sure about radio for different reasons, but if you look at the newsroom, that's the description for all of the employees. And I'm not talking about the management type, although it could be, but the employees, the reporters, that pretty much describes them. So basically, if the Gizmodo report is accurate, Facebook has turned into just another media outlet. But in that sense, they've got the right to do what they want in this land of the First Amendment, and that is probably not going to change until people start dropping Facebook.
All right, John, what do you think?
I just want to make clear that I'm not on the center left.
No, you're not.
Very comfortably on the left. Let's get to the heart of the matter here. Too much power is rested in mega corporations that now control not production of our news, but distribution, right? How we communicate. There is overwhelming power now in Google. There's overwhelming power now in Facebook and in a number of other entities. Our great problem, in fact, Bob McChesney and I just wrote a book about this, People Get Ready, where we talk about the fact that our political discourse and our media discourse in this country has not begun to catch up to where we are technologically. And so issues like this are going to arise. People on the left and the right complain about these mega corporations, which have so much control about what gets highlighted, what doesn't. I've spent a lot of time in Germany over the last few years, and one of the things that's striking there is that they have a much deeper debate about the power of Google in Europe than they do in the U.S. And they highlight the fact that there are real challenges as regards what media outlets are there, who gets so-called Google juice and moves to the top, and who does not. And, you know, as a society, we need to pull a break here and have a deep, serious discussion about the radical shift in communications. We are not protecting the First Amendment in this country. We are not defending freedom of the press with the intents that the founders did. The founders did not write freedom of the press into that First Amendment because they were anticipating Rupert Murdoch or because they were anticipating some search engine. The founders believed that freedom of the press was vital, not as some sort of like hobbyist thing, not to like make sure everybody had their voice. It was to make sure that democracy itself functioned, or some variation thereon, that some sort of people driven. Now, they wanted everybody to have a voice within that. That was true, no question. But they also wanted to make sure that it functioned, that there was real discourse. And our problem now is that we are ceding so much power to multinational corporations that have as their core goal making money. And anybody who thinks that like Google is simply another media company or Facebook is simply another media company misunderstands how we communicate today. And so I would suggest that this is something that our candidates, that our political leaders should be talking about. You can't censor. You just can't. But you can recognize the role and the power of these institutions and figure out how best to make sure that instead of shutting down voices, that we figure out how to amplify a real range of voices and have honest debate. We don't have that today.
I'm going to have to cut this part of the conversation short as we are again past break time. But when we come back, we will talk about some top stories in state politics. We'll talk about why the Walker administration is delaying payment of over $100 million in debt. And other issues. We'll also welcome your input, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking this week with Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, and John Nichols, the associate editor of the Capital Times, Washington correspondent for The Nation. We welcome your comments, too, on the news of the week at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Governor Scott Walker's administration has delayed repaying $101 million in debt, a move that will increase the state's interest costs in the years to come. Walker is blaming President Obama and concerns over the Obama economy. But Democrats say the state isn't able to afford the tax cuts that were passed by Walker and the state legislature. So, Steve, which is it?
Well, I don't believe the Democratic response, but I do think that the Walker administration is probably making a bad move. They should go ahead and repay it. And if that requires cutting positions or something like that to pay for it, do it. I think that, you know, I suppose John and I probably have a different opinion about state finances in a general sense, but I can tell you that state finances are legally, though not factually, balanced, and that is no different from with Walker from anybody else. The fact is that most states have a requirement in their law that the state be balanced by the state government finances be balanced by generally accepted accounting principles. Wisconsin state law requires that every unit of government except state government be balanced by generally accepted accounting principles. So, you know, it's not that Walker is doing anything particularly different. Jim Doyle apparently did the same thing as far as delaying payments, but I think it's kind of dishonest, frankly, to say that, you know, that let me see what the number is. I think it's like $35 billion or so that the state spends every year, that you're going to financially measure state government by the same measure that you might a business that brings in maybe $100,000 a year. Make the cuts, Scott. That would be my answer.
John?
Well, the wonderful fantasy of Scott Walker was that he was a fiscal conservative who really wanted to balance budgets and make everything hunky-dory. And that's certainly what his television ads have said, you know, in each of his races. But the fact of the matter is that what Scott Walker set out to do in 2011 was to restructure state government to some extent, but also to restructure politics. To remember, a budget repair bill in 2011, a budget repair bill was used to go after public employees and unions. And similarly, the governor has, on repeated bases, or on repeated instances, used his power and certainly that of his allies in the legislature to weaken opponents, strengthen the hand of his political allies. When it gets down to the core issues that he talks about so much, balanced budgets, fiscal responsibility, what you see is the old games, right? Putting off a payment, which actually increases the amount of money that taxpayers are going to have to pay out so that things will look good in the immediate moment. And this is a real problem. It gets to the heart of the matter of what's happened in Wisconsin with Democrats and Republicans over a long period of time, and that is sort of false construct budgeting. I always remember that the great socialist mayor of Milwaukee, Dan Hoehn, believed and famously believed that Milwaukee shouldn't borrow. That Milwaukee in the 1930s, even in Depression era, that Milwaukee ought to tax at a level that was necessary to pay for the services that were required. Just basic concept. This is how people actually think that it ought to work. The weird thing was that in Milwaukee in those days, it was regularly rated the best-run city in the country, right? And so there is a real problem, not just with how Walker's doing this, but in general how it's done. And that is that we have politicians who are afraid to make the appeal to the people for the services that people like. And so they play this game and they put all sorts of politics and all sorts of ideology into it. I don't think that Steve and I probably disagree that much about how it ought to work. I think we disagree passionately, and I love our disagreement, about what the ultimate goal is. I think that there's a lot more the state of Wisconsin can and should do. But I believe that budgets are used not as moral documents, as expressions of who we are and what we want to do, but now as vehicles for politicians to lie. And it's a very troublesome circumstance, which has, you know, briefly been exposed here in Wisconsin.
Let's move on to a couple of other topics before we run out of time. Also this week, Government Accountability Board Executive Director Kevin Kennedy told board members that he will retire on June 29th, just a day before the GAB is divided into separate elections and ethics agencies. Kennedy has frequently been at the center of controversy during his tenure at GAB. And some Republican lawmakers were fairly vocal that Kennedy should lose his job. John, quickly, as we've got other topics too, what's your take on Kevin Kennedy's departure?
He served for a long time, and I think he did some very good things. I don't think that in recent years he was a particularly strong leader. I think he was so beaten upon by the political classes, frankly, in both parties, that he was less heard from. I wish that we really had the GAB as it was initially designed. It isn't anymore. It's been deconstructed, and I think Kevin Kennedy is stepping down at a time where he recognizes those changes and that those changes are not for the good. I think it really raises profound questions about whether the GAB still exists in the form that it was intended, and ultimately it raises serious questions about how we ought to organize elections and oversee them in Wisconsin. I wish we could pause and have a big discussion about this, a real debate on it, but I think it's unlikely to happen when you have one-party governance in the legislative and executive branch.
Steve, your thoughts on Kevin Kennedy's retirement?
Well, there was a lot, there was a line in the story that said something about how Kennedy didn't even consider applying for the new position, which is good because he certainly wouldn't have got it. I do tend to think that I am pretty sure that the changes were not necessarily a good idea, in the sense that I don't think you want partisan politicians overseeing partisan politicians. However, the problem is we've become so politicized in this state, and Wisconsin's not different from anywhere else, where there is no such thing as a neutral observer and regulator of anything anymore, and particularly elections. But, you know, when you have a situation where essentially the foxes are deciding who gets to leave the hen house, then I guess that's a little bit of a mangled metaphor, but I don't think politicians ought to be in charge of the political process.
Well, can I just throw in, Steve is right about that. And, you know, one thing he said there is I don't think Wisconsin's any different than any place else. Historically, Wisconsin was different from every place else. It was dramatically better. We had cleaner politics. People teased us about how clean our politics was. It is a tragedy, a fundamental tragedy, that we have moved toward a place now where nobody says that, and where people can comfortably and accurately, as Steve suggests, say that Wisconsin is like every place else.
Wisconsin residents who are in the process of trying to obtain a photo ID card for voting may be able to obtain a ballot without one in upcoming elections. Governor Scott Walker this week signed an emergency rule that will allow polling places to accept receipts issued by the State Division of Motor Vehicles that indicate that a voter is in the process of obtaining an ID. John, good move?
A little bit of a good move. A minor good move. But look, the fact of the matter is that Wisconsin historically has competed to have the highest turnouts in the country. We have done that because our historical commitment was to making it easy to vote and, you know, really kind of bending over backwards to make the process work. I think there are still too many impediments to voting easily. We saw evidence of that in the presidential primary with lines that were ridiculously long and some places that weren't functioning well. I give the governor credit for this small step, but I would hope that it is the first of many, many steps that begin to address the problems that have been developed by the creation of a voter ID law, which simply makes it too hard for a lot of people to vote.
Yeah, what do you think of this emergency rule, Steve?
Rule is fine. I think it is funny that we're talking about how difficult voting was, considering the fact that we just finished one of the highest voter turnout elections that we've had in like 40, 50 years or so in April. So I'm not convinced that there is as much of a problem as John seems to think. I know people who would live, and I'm one of them, who would literally walk, you know, 100 miles to go vote. And when you're talking about a free voter ID, remember, free. The state's going to give it to you for free. I don't, you know, I'm fine with the change. I don't think that there is as much of a problem as John, or as the opponents of voter ID seem to think there is.
Yeah, and I very little time, but I want you both very briefly to comment on the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay Faculty Senate this week approved a resolution expressing no confidence in UW System President Ray Cross and the Board of Regents. It follows similar votes in Madison, La Crosse, River Falls, and Milwaukee. Eau Claire declined to take up a vote. What does this mean, John?
Well, I think that means the faculties in a lot of campuses are very unsettled with both Ray Cross and the regions. I don't think that Ray Cross has been a particularly outspoken or effective advocate for the university. I think that if you read these resolutions that have come down, the no confidence resolutions are written in an interesting way. They ask Ray Cross, as well as the regents, to do a better job, to step up. And that's a little different than no confidence votes usually. Usually they're saying, you know, basically, we want you to go. These are, I think, pleas from the faculty of universities across the state, in a great state university system, for those who are supposed to be the chief advocates for the university system to be better advocates.
Yeah, and less than a minute, Steve.
Well, I think there's a bigger thing going on here, and unfortunately there isn't any time to talk about it, but, you know, the faculty expressed no confidence with UW system leadership. It's perfectly obvious that the Republican Party doesn't have confidence in the UW system, and that has a lot to do with what is getting taught. And, you know, here you have people who are spending big taxpayer dollars to support a world-class university system that their values are not being expressed in classrooms. And there's, you know, there's a number of instances about that. And so it's kind of a tit-for-tat thing, basically.
We will have a lot of other fodder for other programs, lots of follow-up shows. Steve, I understand that not only is today Friday the 13th, but you discovered it's something else?
It is Blame Somebody Else Day, which is apparently the first Friday the 13th of the year. So I'm going to think real quick as to, you know, who else I can blame for whatever.
Well, I give you.
I think everybody should do that.
Not going to blame anybody for a good week in review. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Steve Prestigard is a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, and John Nichols is the associate editor of the Capital Times and Washington correspondent for The Nation. Thanks to both of them for being with us. We will be talking about Republican politics again during our week or our state capitol report on Monday. Sean Johnson will be covering the GOP's annual state convention this week, and we'll talk about it Monday on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.